of Minnesota versus Nicholas Scott Thompson. I appreciate you both being here early and being ready to go forward a little before the time this was scheduled for argument. You are both very familiar with our court procedures. We are glad to see you in person. The rules are the same. You each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal in addition. It's important because we are making an audio recording of this proceeding that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. I will give you both a moment to get yourself settled since we are proceeding a little early. And again, we appreciate your being here. All right, then you may proceed.
All right. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Eriksson, and I represent the appellant this morning, Nicholas Thompson. We raised three issues in our brief. This morning, I'd like to start by focusing on the first issue, and that is that the district court erred by placing the burden on Mr. Thompson to prove he was competent to stand trial. I would like to start by highlighting a couple points from the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State v. Curtis that I think are relevant for this discussion. First, in State v. Curtis, the court held that this process is adversarial in nature. There are burdens of proof that need to be assigned, and it's not a situation where parties can sit on the sideline and not take a position and then ask the court to make a decision. Second, the court reached its decision by determining that Rule 20.01 does not articulate specific burdens, but does so by implication. In other words, there aren't any express burdens that are within the rule. The court found in Curtis that the state had the burden in that case by implying from the rule that the burden was on the state. To better understand our overall position, I think it's necessary to discuss that a defendant is presumed competent to stand trial. Every criminal defendant who walks into a courtroom at that time is competent. The Rule 20.01 provisions are an exception to the rule. Every defendant doesn't have to establish to the court that they are competent to exercise their Sixth Amendment right to trial. In fact, there's no proceedings that need to take place unless Rule 20.01 is invoked. As a result, Rule 20.01 is the exception and not the rule.
Mr. Eriksson, I wonder if this is a case where we can sit on the sideline with the burden of proof. And the reason I say that is because I'm very troubled with some of the findings by the district court. I mean, your client provided pretty extensive testimony about his ability to rationally consult with not one, not two, but three different sets of attorneys, including yourself in the first appeal. And the district court seems to say that there was no evidence, or it did say twice, that there's, quote, no evidence that he was able to rationally consult with counsel. And so why do we even need to address who bears the burden here when it looks like these findings may be clearly erroneous?
Yeah, so ultimately Mr. Thompson's goal in this case is to have a trial. So if this court concludes that he is competent to stand trial and that he is able to rationally consult with his attorneys and also understands the proceedings, which the court continuously found that he understands the proceedings, then he should have his trial.
I don't think that we can find that he's competent. I think that the district court still has to find that he's competent under Kenny.
Well, if this court determines that that he's able to rationally consult with his attorneys and those findings are erroneous, then I don't know how you would remand for the court to find, unless you expressly tell the court you need to find that he can rationally consult with an attorney.
Let me state it a little differently. The district court here said there was no evidence that he was able to rationally consult with counsel, and I think that may be an objectively incorrect factual finding. There is actual evidence, but the district court did not make a credibility determination as to whether that evidence was sufficient to establish that he could rationally consult with counsel. And I don't think that we are in a position to be able to tell the district court how to weigh that evidence. Under Kenny?
Well, under Curtis, and the standard of review for that decision is you independently review those findings and determine whether there was proper weight given.
But we can't weigh them under Kenny.
Well, under Curtis, the standard of review, you can, in that you are to independently review and ensure that. So if this court wants to reverse and remand and say, give this proper weight, I would not object to that remedy. But I also think that the way that Curtis was decided and the other cases that articulate that standard of review, this court does have discretion to reweigh that evidence and say that he is competent to stand trial.
So my other concern is we send it back to the district court to make a determination as to his competency. Say the district court determines that he's competent, and then we end up with a trial, and then we end up here back on appeal with the argument that he was not competent.
Well, there are a few things. One is the attorneys at the district court level have a duty and a candor to the court at any time. If there's any doubt that he is unable or is incompetent, they have to raise that to the district court. So if it is not raised throughout the trial by either his attorney or the prosecutor or the judge, then I don't think there would be an appealable issue. But we don't have to determine that at that point, this point, right? If he goes to trial and is convicted and there is no evidence that he was not competent, then that would not be an issue that this court would reverse on appeal. But I don't think we can look to the future and not make a decision now because of the possibility that there could be reversible error later on. And again, I think that duty is really important even in this case, where if this court finds that he is competent to stand trial, the parties have to continue to recognize that if there's any doubt he's not competent, they have to do something about it.
All right, so let's go back to the original question that I asked. If we were to determine that the factual findings were clearly erroneous and we were to send it back to the district court to engage in weighing of the evidence, do we have to address the burden issue? And if so, why?
Well, we know from Curtis that there is a burden. And right now the burden is either on the state or, as the court, I think, tried to articulate, possibly is on nobody, which violates Curtis. So I think this court does need to decide how the court reweighs that evidence, because the way that the court reached its decision was to say that Mr. Thompson didn't present enough evidence. Throughout the court's order, it was Mr. Thompson didn't do X, Mr. Thompson didn't do Y. So if you remand and say reevaluate the evidence, I think it would be difficult without any instruction regarding how to do that.
And tell me how that would actually work with the state bearing the burden. I mean, I don't know how the state would even know what evidence to present because it doesn't have a relationship with your client and doesn't have the ability to know what witnesses should be called necessarily or know what those witnesses might say. And then what if the state doesn't do a good job? I mean, does your client have an ineffective assistance claim against the state for not meeting its burden? I mean, there's a lot of layers here to assigning the burden to the state when it's the defendant making the motion.
Well, our position is not the defendant making the motion. The defendant's presumed competent. The court requested that a competency evaluation be completed. At that point, he's still presumed competent.
Well, there's been a finding of incompetence.
The court's order at the end of the day, yes.
I mean, originally. I mean, he has been found incompetent, and now there's a contested competency proceeding, right?
That's incorrect. So the way Rule 2001 works is the court is the only party in this whole process that can actually determine that a defendant is not competent. A medical examiner meets with the defendant, makes a recommendation, but it's not until a court actually finds the defendant not competent.
Oh, I understand.
And both prior orders have been reversed, so they don't exist.
I understand.
Yep. So at this point, he is still presumed competent, and he should have his trial unless if this court remands, finds him not competent.
So if I may follow up on Judge Frisch's questioning, I mean, and as Judge Frisch's question, you know, I share some of the concerns about would we have to really reach this issue of burden? But if we did, is it necessarily even a burden of proof? I mean, it's hard to say that goes on this state for the reasons Judge Frisch pointed out, is who would they even know? But at least should there be like a burden of production, you know, perhaps, that we should be looking at, which is, of course, getting into that as before you go to the burden of proof, mm-hmm. opens up a can of worms, which is partly gets back to my, do we have to really reach this in this case
right.
question.
So I will preface all my arguments with the rule is not clear. And this is a very confusing. I've been going back and forth with this case for over 2 years now. So I will start by saying that this, in every case, if the state, if the defendant believes he is competent and the state agrees he is competent, then it's over, right? Just like any other pretrial issue, he is competent, he should stand trial. And as I started my argument with, the state has to take a position, because if there's any doubt, as the rule articulates, of whether he's competent, the state has to go forward and say, we have doubt. So if there isn't doubt, the state agrees. It's over at that point. If the state thinks there's any doubt, the rule allows for the state to present evidence, and within that evidence can be testimony from the trial attorney. They can call the trial attorney. They can ask him questions regarding their relationship, not regarding any privileged information. The rule is very clear about that. But those types of conversations can take place. And that's really the only evidence regarding whether a defendant can rationally consult with their attorney. And if you look closely at Rule 2001, even the examiner's report, there is no required finding regarding whether the defendant can communicate with his attorney. The only thing the examiner is supposed to determine is whether the defendant understands the proceedings and whether he's mentally ill. That last prong regarding rationally consult with an attorney is something that has to take place at the hearing and would take place through calling the defense attorney to talk about their relationship.
Why is it sufficient for the person who is the subject of the proceeding to offer testimony? I mean, that is evidence. That person's own testimony about ability to rationally consult, because we have that testimony here.
That's right. And that, so there's two parts. One is if we're talking about the burden, and this court believes that the state has the burden, then it has to remand no matter what, under Curtis. If the court wants to get to the second question, of course you can consider Mr. Thompson's testimony, and that would refute the state's failure to meet its burden in this case, because Mr. Thompson testified that he is able to discuss things with his attorneys, has no problems with his attorneys. There have been issues in the past, just like we have issues with all of our clients regarding trial strategy and how to go forward. But there was nothing in his testimony that said that he was not able to communicate with his attorneys, and the state didn't present any other evidence saying otherwise.
Is there also some value to the argument that's at the end of the transcript from Mr. Thompson's counsel, where he represents to the court as an officer of the court that he has been able to communicate effectively with his client? I mean, he didn't testify, which is sort of the complaint of the district court, but he did offer that as part of his argument. What right. value should we give to that piece of the record?
I think it would be the same value you would give a trial court saying, I saw the defendant in the courtroom last time and he was acting up, right? That's not actually testimony, but for purposes of determining competency, I think it's, I mean, we are determining whether the defendant is able to have his trial, right? So if his attorney is standing there and saying, I'm able to discuss what our strategy is today and I have no problems, I get that he's not sitting on, you know, he's not being cross-examined and whatnot, but that is evidence. That's part of the circumstances that the court should consider. I think that is part of the strongest evidence in this case that he is competent, is that his attorney at that hearing said, look, I have no problem communicating with him.
If I may, Mr. Erickson, you just told us that, look, the state has to take a position, which sounds like a syllabus point to me, but is that really teed up for us? I'm just quickly looking through your brief. I mean,
That is not an issue. We're not saying that this needs to be reversed because of that, but it's a point that Curtis decided. That in Curtis, at the Court of Appeals, the court said there are no burdens. And the Supreme Court says, yes, there are. This is an adversarial process. So our position is there won't be a situation where there isn't a party on each side. I guess that's the point of that argument, is to say there's not going to be this crazy situation where the state says we're not doing anything and the defense says I want a trial. The state, in fact, is required to take a position and present evidence.
But they expressly did not take a position before the district court, which makes the appeal a little bit incongruous. And Mr. Stockmeyer, you should be ready to answer that question. But so what do we do with that when the state at the competency hearing says, we have no dog in this fight, which is what the prosecutor said.
Right. And I don't think that should get in the way of Mr. Thompson having his trial. And I have a problem with that as well, that the one office, the Attorney General's office, can take a position consistently at the district court and then three times in a row take a different position before this court. I think that if this state has the burden, the state did not meet its burden because it said it didn't want to present evidence.
Well, yes, but the procedural history of this case is just so unique. I mean, I guess Curtis is 2018, but still around all the time this is going on, the law is just being developed. So wouldn't that suggest that the state have an opportunity, that a remand would be the way to proceed?
If this court wants, I have no problem other than, I have no problem with there being a remand because the state should have the opportunity to present its evidence for due process purposes. But if this court believes that the record created now establishes that he is competent and that the court, you know, failed to consider the evidence properly, as Judge Frisch mentioned earlier, you know, I think that can be a reason for remand as well. But ultimately, I do think that this court should instruct that the state should take a position on these issues because Curtis made that clear.
I want to ask, and I know your time is running short, Mr. Erickson, but there was a lot of reliance by the district court on some what I would consider to be stale evaluations. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, the assessment of competency is whether the defendant is currently, at the time of the competency hearing, able to rationally consult with counsel. So can you talk about what the relevance of these prior evaluations would be in the district court's assessment?
Yeah, so every report has, the two reports where he was actually evaluated clearly said he understood the proceedings and that he's a very smart guy. Every subsequent one has relied on that finding. There's been no other finding that he doesn't understand the proceedings. And then as far as whether he rationally consult with an attorney, I think that the most important part of that is what he's able to do now and what his relationships have been with his attorneys now. So you're absolutely right that if he's not competent 2 years ago, but he's competent now, that's all that matters. But as far as the finding that he's able to understand what's going on, I don't think that's ever really been controverted or there's been no other evidence. So the fact that there hasn't been an updated report on that, I don't think that should get in the way of him having his trial.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing for the state of Minnesota. I want to begin by going off script a little bit and address an issue that Judge Frisch, you raised at the very beginning of appellant's oral argument, and that has to do with the adequacy of the district court's findings. So I do want to take issue with the premise of the question you led with. The district court, in its order, found that the testimony from Mr. Thompson about his ability to consult with his attorneys was limited, it was vague, and it was the product of leading questions from competency counsel. Those findings are on pages 2 and 9 of the order. And so I disagree that the district court just said, there's no evidence in front of me. The district court assessed the testimony, the claims of Mr. Thompson in front of it, and found that it was lacking. And that makes sense, in part because on the one side of the balance, you have all these expert opinions, and then you have Mr. Thompson's non-expert testimony and his self-interested belief that he doesn't suffer from a mental illness and is able to consult with his attorneys.
But that's so, still evidence.
It is evidence, but the district court specifically addressed it. So it's not as if the district court said, there's no evidence, I have nothing to address. It specifically addressed the weight it should be giving to Mr. Thompson's testimony.
Well, I'm going to take issue with that, Mr. Stockmeyer. I don't see the district court weighing the evidence. I see the district court describing the evidence.
Well,
and I take issue with the way that it is describing the evidence as well, but it is describing the evidence, and it's not saying how it is weighing it. It's just saying there's no evidence.
Well, Your Honor, if you turn to pages 2 and 9 of
the findings. That's where I'm looking, yep.
So beyond answering leading questions from counsel, which sheds light on the district court's assessment of the testimony it's receiving, it's a product of leading questions, there's no other information about his ability to rationally consult with counsel. So other than the answers to the leading questions, there's no evidence, which is true.
All right, well, maybe it's not true. So on pages 16 and 17 of the transcript, Mr. Thompson is volunteering quite a bit of additional information about his ability to consult with counsel beyond the question that's posed. For example, he says, my relationship with my attorney improved after I requested that counsel get documents for me, and then counsel got documents for me. And then on cross-examination, when the state is asking him questions, he's elaborating on why it is that he feels that he can better consult with counsel now, and that is they're listening to him. They're doing things that he's asking them to do. So he's not just saying yes, no to these questions. He's providing testimony.
He is providing testimony about his ability to work with his attorneys, but the district court found that his testimony did not address his ability to discuss specifically potential defenses in the case or possible outcomes, resolutions of the prosecution. That's on page three. And then on page
And why is that required?
It goes to the specificity of his testimony. So when you're weighing testimony, you do want to look at how thorough is the testimony? Is it really addressing the sort of concerns at the heart of the legal issue? And the district court is finding that this testimony is just too limited to really establish a basis for finding that he is able to rationally consult with his attorneys.
So then where's the floor? What does a defendant have to, I mean, this gets to the burden, right? But what does a defendant have to say or do, or what does counsel have to say or do to say, I can rationally consult with counsel?
I would posit that it would be helpful. I mean, I don't want to put forward a rule because it's going to be different in every case because the issues between attorneys and clients are different. But it would be helpful for a defendant to testify, these were the specific defenses that we discussed. Here is where there was a breakdown. Here is why there was a breakdown.
So the defendant has to reveal his privileged information?
Well, he...
What he consulted with his counsel about? I don't think so.
Your Honor, I am trying to recall, because the rule specifically addresses some of the privilege aspects, and I'm trying to recall exactly what they are. I defer to what the rule says.
Let me ask it a different way. I'm just going to move you off of his testimony and get to what his counsel said at the end of the hearing, which was, I'm representing to the court that I can rationally consult with this individual. What do we make of that? That's something beyond his testimony.
Right. First of all, it's not evidence. But in addition, you know, to the extent that the district court wants to give that weight, I think it would be allowed to. Appellant's counsel analogized that to the district court making observations of how the defendant has interacted with people in the courtroom. But the district court has observed those specifically. That's the fact finder viewing that. Here, it's the product of a representation that the district court hasn't had any opportunity to evaluate on its own. It's not direct knowledge that the district court has. So I think that's different. Again, I do think the district court can take that into consideration, but it's not obligated to. What I want to say, the biggest point I want to make about this case is that let's say that appellant is right, that the state has the burden to prove incompetency. To earn relief in this case, Mr. Thompson still has to show that there was some defect in the state's presentation of that issue. So on the burden of production, the state very clearly presented substantial evidence of incompetency. The state entered all of these exhibits into evidence at the hearing. Those were the state's exhibits.
But the state took no position, which makes today a little bit incongruous.
But it produced the evidence, Your Honor. I'm speaking to the you know, burden of proof. There's the burden of production and the burden of persuasion. State very clearly produced the evidence. So then on the question of the burden of persuasion, it seems to me that the state satisfied that burden too. Even if the state said, you know, we're not taking a position, the burden of persuasion refers to the legal standard of the preponderance of the evidence standard of review.
Mr. Stockmeyer, would you go specifically address Mr. Erickson's point that, you know, his position that the state has to take a position on competency and that Curtis, I'm looking at it now, dictates that?
Your Honor, I don't think Curtis dictates that. Curtis says that there has to be a party who, upon whom the burden lies. Our position, it's on the defendant in this case. But that the Curtis also holds that the unambiguous text of Rule 20.01 Subdivision 5C is that it creates a presumption of incompetence. And so we start. If the evidence is in equipoise, the defendant is incompetent. And I want to clarify, when I say presumption of incompetence, that presumption kicks in once the district court has an adequate concern for competency and orders an evaluation. So my friend is correct that, you know, at the first appearance, the defendant is presumed competent. But once we've gone down this road and we have reports, Curtis holds that the presumption is in favor of incompetence. And you can only, if what that means is you can only go forward with a trial if it is proved by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant is competent to be tried. And so I don't mean to interrupt, Your Honor.
I'm just wondering, though, is at least it, because I'm like you, looking at Curtis, I don't see it directly stated that, but that the state needs to take a position be implicit upon by the court talking about this? Isn't the competency proceeding being an adversarial process?
I don't think so, because I think the state's position that what the Court of Appeals ruled is that basically the parties go in, nobody has to do anything, and the court just has to weigh whatever is in the record. There's no burden on anybody. But where there is a presumption of incompetence, so that's our starting point, you have a defendant who wants to go to trial. So he needs to overcome that presumption, and that does not mean that the state has to take the contrary position. The state can just say, we understand this is the presumption, we have this record in front of us, we can't in good faith go to trial if every expert, five different experts, are opining that he is incompetent.
But then the state could take a position on the other side and say, our position is he is incompetent, or as opposed to just saying, we have no dog in this.
So I guess one point I want to make is I don't know why the state would. I think we're just arguing about how the state frames its position there. It could come in and say, Your Honor, this is the presumption, and sort of that's where we are. We don't take a position. Or the state could say, we think the defendant is incompetent. I don't know why the state would have to frame it one way or the other. Particularly, the state might have questions, and I'm not saying the state has questions in this case, but there might be a case where the state has questions about, well, we're suspicious that this defendant is malingering. The experts haven't said that he is, but we are suspicious of that. And so the state might have independent reasons for maybe not being totally on board with what the examiners have concluded. I have seen cases where the opinion about the defendant's conduct has evolved over time. It started with, sure looks like incompetency, and then by the time there's a fourth or fifth progress report, we're actually getting opinions that this is formally malingering. And so I don't think that the state is obligated to side with the unanimous opinion of the experts. The state is obligated to follow its ethical obligation not to go to trial if there's reason to at least doubt the defendant's competency. So I just don't understand where this notion that the state's position is not we have to go to trial now. So if the state's position isn't about overcoming the burden, why the state has to take a particular position? I don't know if that's the rule of law. I don't know what the source of law is for that proposition. Again, Curtis held it's a presumption of incompetence here. And so it just makes sense that you, in order to go to trial, you have to prove competence. And if the defendant is the one who wants to go to trial, it's the defendant's burden.
Counsel, I know you're running a little short on time. I want to draw your attention to paragraph 5 of the conclusions of law. I'm concerned about the district court's, what it appears to me to be a finding that in the absence of a medical examination finding that the defendant is competent, that the district court cannot find that the defendant is competent. And I'm not aware of the legal authority that would substantiate that proposition. Without a concrete medical opinion, no affirmative opinions of competency, and Thompson's testimony, the court cannot find there is clear and convincing evidence that he is competent. What's the legal basis of that?
Well,
or is that erroneous?
Your Honor, I think that the court is, that's part of the court's weighing of the evidence. So again, it's preponderance of the evidence standard. So in order to go to trial, the evidence of competency has to preponderate. And so if the court is assessing the full evidentiary record in front of it, and it said, I don't have any medical opinion favoring competency, I don't have opinions of competence, except for maybe the defendants, but that's a non-expert, self-interested testimony. And as I argued earlier, I think the district court did assess its weight. Thompson's testimony of the court, I think it's just referring back to the prior assessment of his testimony that the court engaged in. That's our evidentiary record in front of the district court, I can't find that he's competent.
So you're reading this differently than I am, that you would agree that a medical opinion is not required for a determination of competency.
Correct, Your Honor. In particular, because the expert opinions don't have the legal expertise that the judge has. They have the sort of medical and forensic expertise.
So
and
why is it that the state now is arguing in favor of the finding of incompetency when it took no position before the district court?
Well, I am to a certain extent defending the decision of the district court. But in addition, you know, some of this was brought up during appellant's arguments. I do have concerns about what this looks like if this court issues some sort of order that says the district court did this wrong. When we go back to the district court, remember, the parties are obligated to raise any concerns they have about competency, and that triggers this process. The district court then has to make an assessment. If the prosecutor comes into court and the prosecutor has all of these unanimous opinions saying this defendant's incompetent, and by the way, they're stale because the defendant has refused to participate in any further examinations. But if that's what the prosecutor has, I think the prosecutor is obligated to raise a concern about competency. And I think the district court would as well, and I think trial counsel would as well, because there is a concern based on that history. And so then we're just right back where we started. And so I don't think that that makes sense. What we are defending here is we don't have any evidence of defendant's competency, what we think of as competent evidence of defendant's competency. We have these medical opinions, and we cannot in good faith on that record alone say, let's go to trial. We have obligations, and I don't think that that would be proper. And if I could make one more point, I see my time is up, if I could make one more point. I do want to refer this court to Cooper versus Oklahoma. It's a due process case, and this case isn't strictly about due process. But in Cooper versus Oklahoma, the Supreme Court said that the due process standard serves to protect against erroneous conclusions of competency and trying incompetent defendants. And so Minnesota's rule, which creates a presumption of incompetence and which obligates attorneys to raise these issues whenever there's any concern, that is a rule that is more protective of the fundamental right not to be tried while incompetent. And so I think that's problematic. If we're just going forward with a trial, I have concerns about what the appeals are going to be on direct appeal, and I have concerns just about everybody's obligation in that situation. And so if there's no further questions, we simply ask this court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Erickson, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. First off, I'll kind of start where Mr. Stockmeyer left off. This idea of protecting a defendant's due process, and our position is the presumption is triggered when the defendant makes a decision as to how he wants to proceed. So a report comes back. Defendant says, I want to continue to exercise my Sixth Amendment right to counsel, or excuse me, Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. At that point, it's the state's burden to prove that he is not competent. If the defendant, as in Curtis, once he gets that report, says, I am not competent, then it's the state's burden at that point under Curtis to prove that he is competent. It's not receiving the report. It's what constitutional right the defendant is pursuing. Is the defendant saying, I am incompetent and my due process rights will be violated? Then it's, and the state believes he is competent, then it's the state's burden to prove he's competent.
So, Mr. Erickson, the same might be true when the court questions competency, which it can do under Rule 2001. Yeah. And so what do you do, who bears the burden when we have the situation where the district court says, I'm questioning the defendant's competence, and both the defendant and the state say, he's competent or she's competent? Then what? Then who has the burden?
Yeah, so I think after Curtis and my initial point regarding this adversarial system, because we have Curtis, I think if the state has no doubt that he is competent and the defense attorney has no doubt he is competent, then he is competent.
But the court has the ability to question competency as well.
That's right.
I mean, certainly the state has an interest in pursuing its criminal charges and the defendant has an interest in pursuing and getting out of custody ostensibly, right? And getting their case tried. Mm-hmm. But the court may have questions, and it is the guardian of the due process rights of the defendant that it can see if the defendant is not competent or questions competency. So then what do we do?
Yeah, and I understand that point, and I think if we didn't have Curtis, I think that would be the law, that the court can look at the evidence and say, make a decision.
And how would it even get evidence?
That's the thing.
And other than a court-ordered examination.
Right. Well, a couple things. Rule 20 allows the court to call witnesses and gives the court the power to do that. But again, because we have Curtis, there are sides to the issue. And if the state, and again, and we're talking about why the state didn't take a position in this case. The rule specifically says that if the prosecutor has any doubt, it must raise the issue.
I'm running through my mind what this proceeding would look like if this was all initiated on the court's initiative.
As it was in this case. I mean, the court was the one who initiated everything here. Mm-hmm. And then the state said, we're not taking a position.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume because the state's not taking a position, they didn't have any doubt. The defense, Mr. Thompson wants his trial. So we have two parties saying he is competent. At that point, he is competent, according to Curtis, because there has to be sides taken. And if he goes to trial and the prosecutor still thinks he is competent and doesn't have any doubt, that, I mean,
but why,
we're stuck there.
So your argument really is that the Supreme Court statement holding that this is an adversarial process means that in every case the state has to bear the burden of showing competence.
I think this Curtis's decision stating that it is adversarial, along with Rule 20.01 stating that if the prosecutor has any doubt regarding the defendant's competency, it must raise it. Those two combined result in the state having to take a position, no matter what. And if they don't have any doubt, he's competent, according to the state, right? If they don't have any doubt, then they have to say that he's competent.
But in this case, I mean, clearly, all the documents the state said, take no position, but all of the documents they submitted to the district court suggests incompetency.
All of those documents result in the conclusion that he understands the proceedings. I really think it's important to break down the word competency, because just saying he's mentally ill and therefore he's not competent is not how Rule 20 works, and that's not how the criminal justice system works. He can be mentally ill. He can understand the proceedings, and he can rationally consult with his attorney and have his trial. And we have a lot of cases where our clients are in that position where they might have some mental illness, but they still have a constitutional right to trial unless the state proves otherwise. I see my time is winding down. If the court has any other questions, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, we...
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. It's a very interesting issue presented, important, and we appreciate your help and arguments today in briefing. Thank you so much. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period.